whole life. It's been so bizarre. It makes me cry to think about it, because it was such an emotional, it just went dead. And I believe there are websites devoted to the hatred of Steve Allen.
Conversations, an occasional radio moment series in which we talk to those who made a difference. Steve Allen.
I can only remember listening to The Archers with my parents because they happened to listen to that. There was no commercial radio at all when I was growing up. We didn't have any commercial. It didn't come in till the 70s. So when I was growing up, it was we had a radiogram. We used to listen to a Round the Horn on the radio because that was the comedy radio series. And you'd listen to Kenneth Williams and you'd laugh, but you didn't know why you were laughing.
So I popped into a bookshop in the King's Road. It was called Boner Books. Hello, anybody there?
Oh, hello, I'm Julian and this is my friend Sam.
Oh, hello.
And it was very camp, but we didn't know why. They're just sort of funny men. And we laughed at it, but that was my only radio. I wasn't interested in radio. I didn't make radios in my bedroom. I didn't sort of be a radio ham. I didn't do anything like that at all. There was no radio. I was just interested in nothing, really, as a child. I didn't, you know, I played with toy cars and I had friends. I didn't do football, so I didn't do sport. I didn't do anything like that. I was almost, in a way, a sort of an introverted child. Not introverted because I didn't have any friends, but introverted because I liked my own company, which I think in radio is actually quite good. You know, I don't need a big audience around me. I don't need a studio full of people to get me going. I can manage it quite nicely with myself and a bag of jelly babies. But in the early days, I didn't bother with radio at all because nobody had transistor radios. We just had the radiogram in the sitting room, and that was it. And it was nice. I didn't think I was missing anything in life. I didn't think I was.
Would you be interested in Spencer's Fairy Queen?
No, he's not interested in mine.
Oh!
It began with a club called the Tuesday Night Club, which me and some friends from school decided we wanted to set up a youth club. And we set up a youth club. We rented the local church hall, which was sort of this corrugated iron place. It's still there in Newbury, in Battery End. It sounds like something out of New York, Battery End. And at the end of this road, before it hits the common, there is this thing. And it used to have glass windows at the top, but we used to climb up on the roof and cover it with tarpaulins to make it dark inside so that we could have a disco. But we didn't have any disco equipment. But I remember my Uncle Alan, who lived in Ilford, had in his garden shed two speakers and an amplifier, a valve amplifier. And so when we went down there, I said, could I have it? And he said, yes, of course you can. And so what we used to do every Tuesday night is we had a little box of records. I mean, we can't have had any more than 10 records because we didn't have any money. We were just children, you know, 15 years old. And we had the disco. And because local kids thought that was really good, we had people queuing to come in, and so we did our own disco, and we bought a few more records, and then we decided to splash out, and we bought a Carlsberg amplifier and 200 watt speakers, which came with leatherette, and that was really quite exciting. So that was sort of the forerunner of being a DJ. We had a really cheap little, you could buy a microphone in those days for £1.49, and it was passable, you know, one through like bit like that. And so I learnt to DJ. And the kids loved it, and it was great. And I got friendly with a guy called Rick James, who was running a disco in the Newbury area, and he had orange speakers, 250 watts each, and a cheap little deck set up. He could bang out the noise like there was no tomorrow, and I thought that was great. So we set up our disco as the Jackson Ross Roadshow, because we thought Jackson, Michael Jackson, Diana Ross, and we played a lot of Motown. And so I, together with my friend Terry Hackwell and a couple of others, we would go out, we made light boxes and everything else. And so I started DJing in the local area. We had a little mini traveller, which my father had, and we broke the suspension on it because we were piling all this stuff in there, four of us in the car, and the whole back was taken up with these speakers and everything else. And so we did that around Berkshire for, you know, getting a little bit of money here, there and everywhere. And then I saw an advert, and the advert was in... it was a company called Europa Bookings. It was in Record Mirror, and it said DJs wanted for Denmark. And I thought, I'm going to be a DJ. I didn't quite know what it entailed. I just know that I'd done it for the local club, and it seemed to work quite well. So I wrote off to this guy called Jerry Coord, who was running it. And he said, yes, come over, and, you know, it'll be great. We'll have a look around and see what there is. So I packed my little belongings up at the age of, I would have been, by this time, probably, I left school at 15. I wouldn't have been much more than 17, 18. And off I go on DFDS ferries over to Denmark to a place called Esbjerg, which was right up the top in Jutland. And going over on the boat, I was violently ill because the seas was choppy and I wasn't a particularly good sailor. Get over to Denmark and there wasn't any work, but he was obviously trying to palm me off to all these women in these discos. He'd take me out to these discos and then say, she likes you. You could go and live with her or something. What am I doing here? And I'd lugged my records over in a box that nearly broke my back. It was like a coffin. And on the way over on the boat, I'd met various other DJs and they all had gimmicks. One had the invisible dog, which was the stiff dog. And I'm thinking, I don't have a gimmick. I had a pair of loons and a satin jacket. And that's what I thought was what people had. And so I stayed there for about 2 weeks in his house. I didn't have any money. I'd run out of money. And I wanted to go home. And so I went to the local phone box and I phoned my parents. And I said, I want to come home. It was kind of like admitting failure. I didn't think it was the kind of thing. I tried not to. But there was, unfortunately, there was a lorry driver strike at the time. So my father had to drive down to Harwich to come and pick me up from the boat. And I'd said to Jerry, it's not really for me, this. I'm going to leave it. I don't want to be a DJ. And I couldn't wait to get back home again. I didn't know what I was going home to. I just knew that I didn't want to be in Denmark with a load of DJs, some of whom are probably still there to this day, I should imagine, still doing the club, still picking up the women night after night. And so I kind of came back and got back into a little bit of DJing. And then I saw a job advertised for DJs in London called Good Hughes. And Good Hughes had a lot of venues. The Castle in Richmond, which was a big barn of a place, used to hold about 2,000 people. There was Boobs in Croydon at the Blue Anchor. There was the Gunnersbury Tavern in Ealing. There were loads of these places. And so I came up to London to audition with my friend Rick, who was the one who had the orange speakers, and he was established. I got a job, he didn't. And they said, yeah, we'd definitely like to take you on. We can give you a Saturday night here. Wow, I thought, Saturday night. So I borrowed my mother's Mini and I drove up to London for my first gig at the Castle in Richmond with a very poor selection of records, it has to be said, because I didn't know what people danced to. They certainly didn't dance to Atomic Rooster and stuff like that. They were looking for the disco things, which I learnt after a while. And so I did that and I was getting, I think it was £18 a night. Well, I thought I'd arrived. 18 quid a night was like a fortune. And so I did this for a couple of weeks. And then they said to me, they said, very nice. And would you like to do some other nights at some of these other clubs? So this was, yeah, I was still living at home in Newbury, driving all the way up the motorway, all the way back, you know, at midnight, 12:30 at night. And so I started working in the Gunnersbury Tavern. I went out to Boobs in Croydon. And then I went to the Castle one night. They said, we've given you a relief DJ for the night, somebody who'll come on and give you a break. So you do the first bit of the show, they'll then give you a break at about sort of 10 o'clock for an hour, and then you pick up and do the rest of the night. I said, OK, fine. We've given you a guy called Dale Winton. So I said, right, OK. So anyway, I'm doing my thing, and then in it breezes. In it comes, with a flurry of talcum powder, lot of hair, very fat. Hi. So I said, hello, I'm Dale. So I said, all right, looking at him thinking, don't rate this one very much indeed. And he said, I'm going to give you a break, Steve, for an hour, and it's nice. And so you can go and have a drink or something. I'll just sort of faff around. And I thought, so I said on the microphone, I said, OK, I'm going to take a short break now, leave you in the company of Dale Winton. And a cheer went up because he'd had a residency out in Tottenham and he brought some of his people over. They'd all trekked over to watch him because he had money. He had money, so he had a really good record collection. And he went on the microphone, and he went from being this, hi, Steve, to, hi, this is Dale.
Hi, this is Dale Winton.
And he went in, he launched into being a DJ. And he could do everything. He could talk up to the vocals, he could spin the records backwards. Even if the record was running out on this one, he'd just lift up the needle and go, fantastic, let's listen to it again. He put it back on the beginning, and off we went again. And he was very casual, but he knew what he was doing. He was very into his music. He was working at HMV at the time.
I went to work for EMI, and all I was doing was, I was working in the HMV shop in London, in Oxford Street, a huge shop, and they cling film every record, or polywrap, as they think call it. And I used to work the polywrap machine.
So he knew all the records, he knew all the music. He was just very good. And so we started going out. Whenever he came over to be my relief DJ, he said, I'll hang around. He said, and we'll go and get a bite to eat at the airport. So we used to go to the Skyline Hotel and buy a club sandwich. I mean, that was the extent of our rock and roll lifestyle, a club sandwich. And we sort of got very friendly over the years, and then we found that we were doing... It was a little circuit of Good Hughes DJs, and Peter Tate was on the circuit as well, who used to work up north as well, and loads of other people who were desperate to make it into radio, but they hadn't quite made it into radio, and I didn't have any thoughts about making it into it. It never even crossed my mind. And then Dale said, he said, why don't you come and see my boss? He said, because he runs UBN. And I said, what's that? And he said, it's an industrial radio station, the United Biscuits Network. I said, oh, right.
The home of good baking, super sound UBN.
The reason it was set up is to stop the workers deserting United Biscuits. It was supposed to make them feel that like they belonged. So you could talk to Peggy and Tess on Jelly Rounds number 5 in Liverpool, or you could talk to Mike up on the packing line in Manchester and Scotland. You know, you'd have all the shortbread made up there and stuff like that. They were based in Austerley. I was doing the club down in Richmond and Ealing, which was within striking distance quite easily for me of a night time. And I went up to see the guy, Alan King, who was running UBN at the time, and he sat me in a studio and he just said, well, play around. So I sort of queued up various records and chatted and all the rest of it. Without really, I just thought I was doing it to myself, but he could hear in his office. He had a speaker system which could listen into it with three studios and a news booth. And then at the end of it, he said, thank you very much indeed, I'll drop you a line. And he wrote me a letter, which I've still got, saying, I'd very much like to offer you a job doing the overnight show, 1 till 4, I think it was, because they just fired the overnight presenter for being drunk. And so I used to do the disco till midnight and then go up to UBN and do my sort of overnight shift there. Then I got the regional programme, which means that they could split, because United Biscuits went out to Manchester, Liverpool, Tollcross and Harlesden, plus Austerley. And it was just dead easy. You could put the whole of the Carpenters Live at the Palladium on and go off for 16 minutes, you know, if you wanted to.
Do you think people are more aware of the dangers of running instead of walking, not wearing safety shoes, especially in your case, being slippery?
And we were earning, I'll tell you exactly what we were earning in those days, £400 a month. That was £100 a week. That was like a fortune. There were two industrial stations. One was run by Kimberly Clark, which was the tissue people. And then there was UBN, which was set up by a company called Sound Development. And in the early days, it was Roger Scott, Nicky Horn, Graham Dean, Adrian Love. All these sort of people were there.
UBN will bring you music 24 hours a day, as well as up-to-the-minute news and items of interest to you, the listener.
And it was run like a commercial radio station. We didn't have any restrictions. We were supposed to log all our records. We had a record library. We had a librarian. We had a program controller. He had a secretary. And there was quite a number of presenters, and we all worked. And if you wanted extra money, like an extra £12, you did the overnight shift into Saturday morning, because we used to close down Saturday and then open up on Sunday evening. And we did the horse racing results. And it was a proper professional setup. The programmes were 4 hours long. We had really big decks in there. These were sort of industrial style. They had a gear change to move through, and you could stand on these things. And we used to have calling cards that came in each factory. So they would fill in a calling card, which had numbers, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, so you knew which factory it came from, 5 being Scotland, 1 being Austerley. And they would put it in the internal mail, it would come down to us, and it would go into the presenters' pigeonholes, and you'd read out the requests. But because we were in London, we had a high percentage of Asian workers in Austerley and in Harlesden, and they used to bring in their own Indian film records. So the girls would turn up at the door, hi thief, brought you this one, and they go, can you play track 2, track, because we didn't know what they were at all. We had no idea what we were playing, but I became quite an expert on Indian film music, and so we would play one of those an hour to keep the workers happy. And it trundled along really nicely. It was a lovely place to work. They'd given us a piece of office. So you went in, there was Alan's office on the right-hand side. He used to snoop tape us overnight. He was a bit naughty, and we'd know if he was snoop taping, because we'd stand on a chair in the corridor and look in, and if there was a red light, he had a cassette recorder linked in. So every time your microphone went on, it started recording. And when you pulled the mic down, it turned it off. So he didn't have to listen to the music. He could just listen to your links. And he would then come back and say to you, listen, don't introduce a record and then back announce it. You've either do one or the other. Don't introduce it and then come off the back and go, oh, that was the Beatles, having already told them it's the Beatles. He said, never say welcome back. It infers everybody's gone away. He said there were all these little things that you had to remember about broadcasting. And slow down. Don't gabble. You're gabbling too much. Be more articulate. And I didn't really know what style of presenter I was supposed to be. So I just thought you're supposed to be butch. So I just tried to affect this sort of butch accent. And then I got to read the news, because I was a very good news reader. I'm a very good sight reader. I can sight read anything. And so he said, that's good. And 79 was quite an interesting year, because they closed UBN down. We got notice that because of the lorry driver's strike, it was no longer viable for Sound Developments, the company that ran it, to operate it as a station. It was really bizarre. And Alan was freelancing LBC as a newsreader, and he said, why don't you apply to LBC as a newsreader? And I said, not really too sure. But I thought, oh, it's a job. And so what we did, we lifted an LBC bulletin, an IRN bulletin, and he cut out the newsreader. We'd written down what their words were, and I recorded it and put my voice in so they could hear what I sounded like reading their bulletin. And I got offered a job immediately. I mean, I went to Gough Square. I'd bleached my hair the day before. I looked a bit like Bette Lynch. Alan walked out and went, what have you done to your hair? I said, I've gone blonde. He said, it looks ridiculous. Anyway, they offered me a job, newsreading, and I got, I think, 3 or 4 shifts a week, and the money was incredibly good, I thought. Incredibly good. And that's only because I could sight read. But meanwhile, back at UBN, I'd started work there on the 12th of December at LBC, but was still working UBN. And they then were contacted me going, we've just played your news bulletin. We used to take the IRN news because it was used to wait for the clip. It was a timed bulletin. The second hand would hit the top and you'd go, it's 10 o'clock, this is Steve Allen.
It's 11 o'clock, this is Steve Allen.
And the out cue was independent radio news. It's 3 minutes past 10. Pause for 1 second. All the stations opt out. And at UBN, they were doing exactly the same. They were sort of opting out and they would go, we heard you on the radio. It was so exciting. We heard you on proper radio and all this kind of thing. But I didn't get the excitement. To me, there was no excitement doing it. I was just reading a bulletin. And then on the 19th of December, which is when it closed, we were all there. We'd got all the past presenters, or as many as we could find, to record their goodbyes to UBN. So we got everybody saying, you know, thank you very much indeed.
Hi, this is Steve Allen. When I first joined UBN 4.5 years ago, I never realised that one day it would close. It's more than a job, it's a family, a way of life. We're also one of the best teams around.
And then when Alan had the final word, and I think we finished with The Who, if memory serves me correctly, because that was the song the station opened up with, and we're all listening in the library, and we had a box on the wall. Each studio had a box on the wall with all the stations lit up, and then because we had compression built into the desk, if the music hit a particular down bit, all the lights would start flashing all around us. And the compression kicked in. So we're all standing there, and Alan did his final work. It still makes the hair on my arm stand up now, because I can remember to this day standing in that library, and there was about 10 of us crammed in there, and we're all listening, and nobody said a word. Nobody said a word. And Alan said, the time is whatever it was, on December the 19th, 1979, I can't remember what it was now, and he said, UBN is now closing down.
The time is 3 o'clock on Wednesday, the 19th of December, 1979. UBN is now closing down.
And then all of a sudden, all the lights started flashing all over the board. And I'm going to cry now. It makes me cry to think about it, because it was such an emotional... It just went dead. For the first time, it was like the day the music died. It was just... We stood there and we all looked at each other and we just cried. It was so sad. So sad. Still sad now. It's amazing how it affects me, even now. It's very odd talking about something as stupid as a station closing down. But it was these lights. I can remember it vividly. And then the next day, we had to go back and start taking our stuff out.
Baby.
And of course, I'm terrible for that, because I build up things all over the place. Everywhere I go, I've got rubbish. I'm terrible. And then the UB people started coming and dismantling the studios, which was, it's like watching your life disappear. You think, I worked here. You know, I'd given my life for a few years, and it was we knew everybody. And all of a sudden, we became like sort of just outsiders. It was terribly sad, terribly, terribly sad. But I had the job at LBC, and that was in Gough Square. And so I was happily newsreading until they said, you know, would you like to present the overnight programme, Night Extra? Wasn't particularly bothered. Couldn't really care less, because the Night Extra programme, it was a 4-3 split in the shift. You did four nights, then the other person did Weekend Night Extra, and that was a guy called Hugh Williams. I thought the weekend sounded a lot better, actually. I don't know why I thought it was better, because with hindsight, it probably wasn't. And I took over during the week from a woman called Carol Allen. And Carol Allen was our film critic as well, and she used to do very lengthy interviews during the day with sort of worthy film people, which I laugh about now, because I didn't. My first interview was so much rubbish. And so I started doing overnights, four nights a week, for £8,900 a year. I thought I was rich as Croesus. I thought I was the richest person in the world, and I was on the radio, but I didn't quite understand what being on the radio meant. I'm not a radio anorak. I don't know anything about it. I don't know how it works. I don't know who the people are. I just know people in my sort of sphere of it. And, you know, and people say, oh, you did that and you did this, and I can't remember any of it. It's just flotsam and jetsam to me. It just sort of, it appears from nowhere. And so thus began a very happy period of time working for LBC doing the overnights. And my only ambition was to do weekend night extras. So I was quite grateful when Hugh Williams decided to leave. And I said to them, could I do weekend night extra? And they went, yes, I don't see any reason why not. They went, yeah, same money, three nights a week. This was result time. There weren't too many phone-ins on LBC. There was Brian Hayes in the morning. Then there was the Nightline phone-in. There was nothing overnight. What you were supposed to do overnight was do the rehash of the day's news. So your producer, in my case it was Mike Carson and Ian Marshall, would come in, and there used to be a stack of tapes in each Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, and they would go through it, and they had bits of paper in them telling you that the queue was in there, how long it was, the pop points, you know, the moments you can opt out. And we had all these, and so they would go through them, and they'd go, oh, we've got a 7-minute. If it was 7 minutes, they were very excited. We'll put a 7-minute piece in here. And can you fill either side of that? With what? With what? I don't know what to fill it with. So anyway, so we sort of filled it all up. So your whole programme overnight was, it's now 12 minutes past one. Earlier on today, Rodney Bennett went down to London Zoo, where Chi-Chi and Ann have just given birth to a little baby, blah, blah, blah. And then you would run this feature. Then we discovered the Brian Hayes archive, which had all his big celebrities from the day. You know, I mean, big celebrities he had in, you know, the Betty Davises. And so we would start running those overnight. And then we'd get to 5 in the morning, and then it would be morning music. And morning music was this dreary bit of classical stuff that went on, which would practically send you around the twist. And it was sort of the transition from overnights into the breakfast programme, by which time Bob Holness had arrived. But overnights were just that. And I thought, this is boring. I thought it was really dull, actually. I thought, what can I do? So I started making letters up, which I thought, I mean, I didn't think it was particularly innovative. I just thought it was quite funny. So I used to make letters up, which was very, it had the desired effect, because people started writing. And then it gave me something to talk about on the programme. I would sort of make up letters, then people would write in. And by the end of, I think it was probably 2 months, we're getting a good, healthy few hundred letters a week, which gave me the basis for a programme, so I could talk about and say, oh, so-and-so's written into me. Because there was no computers, there was no mobile phones, nothing like that at all. And then somebody gave me a set of papers. And that kind of transformed it, really, because I was able to go through the papers and do stories about things that had been in the papers. And before I knew what had happened, people were sort of taken to him. It acquired cult following, which was not what they wanted at all. They didn't want to have that kind of thing overnight on their radio station. And I got a very stern letter from Peter Thornton and Ron Onion saying this will cease immediately. And they said this will stop. We do not want this overnight. You will go back to doing what you were doing before. So I thought, oh, God, I'm going to be fired. And so we went back immediately to the tapes. And, of course, all the people who'd been listening to the programme, what's going on? So they wrote in their droves, and within a week and a half, it had gone back to where it was again. They'd said, no, we've changed our mind. You can now do what you want to do. So I was very lucky in that respect. And they left you alone. I always worry, if ever I get a phone call from my boss or anybody else like that, he now has to put on there nothing to worry about, because I worry about it naturally. I think, oh, God, what have I said? What have I done? And in the early days, we didn't seem to be governed by anything apart from the radio authority, but nobody really bothered with it because we didn't have any competition. There was us, and then there was Capital that came online, and then gradually a few more things. But there was no competition at all, absolutely nothing for us to compare with. So the audience figures didn't make any difference at all to me, whether they said they were good. In fact, I don't think for all those years we're in Gough Square, I don't think I ever looked at audience figures. I don't think I ever knew what my audience figures were. It turns out they were actually very good, but we had nothing to base it on at all. It was just ridiculous. And so I carried on doing that. And then they used me at weekends. And then they started using me for cover for outside broadcasts. You know, if it was an outside broadcast, oh, Steve will do that. We can send Steve down the Ideal Home Show. He'll sit in a glass greenhouse while people press their noses up against the glass. Before you hit reception, you would go in. On the right-hand side would be a little box. And the box had Peter in it. That was the first person you encountered. He looked like Mr. Pastry. Peter used to do all the bingo games in the newspaper, in the Daily Star. And he had the cash box, because in those days, if the car brought you in, Larry or whoever, Jock, they would come in and go, oh, it's £3.30, and Peter would pay them out of the little cash box. Ahead of you was a little step up, three steps. To the left was the reception with Eileen, and if you went through the doors, you went down to the bottom, and there was Paul Easton sitting down there in his booth and everything else, and that was engineering. If you came past reception and crossed to the right, that was the working room. That's where all the programmes came from. That's where they would do their set-up news information with Vivian Fowle and Charlie Rose. And they used to cut the papers every day and put them into the archives because we didn't have anything else. And Vivian would be in charge of booking the celebrities of Brian Hayes. There was a pecking order. The pecking order was, if you were on Night Extra, you were at the bottom of the list. There was no chance of getting anybody from anywhere at all if there were any celebrities in town, so you had to kind of make your own material. Downstairs were the studios. To the right downstairs was the dumping store, which they eventually turned into the new newsroom, and that's where all the journalists sat for IRN, and then through double doors, master control, little booths on the right-hand side for doing interviews in, which were quite nice, actually, very simple. It was just a tape machine, a mixing desk with three mics on it, and that was it. And you just push play and record. Happy days, let me tell you. Nowadays, I can't even I don't even know what this stuff does in here. I've got no idea, it doesn't mean anything to me. And then off to the left, two studios, Studio A and Studio B, engineer-operated. We didn't have any self-op at all in those days. There was no self-op. And there was everybody. Alan was the most common name. Dominic Allen, Carol Allen, Peter Allen. They were all there. I don't know where they all came from. I know where they all went to. And we had a religious affairs correspondent, Lawrence Spicer, who died a while ago. And we had a sports desk. There was the city desk, which was all the financial with Douglas Moffat. And then there were all the producers and the IRN desk who were drunk most of the time. Overnights was especially bad with Lynn Edgerton and everybody else. And they would sit down with bottles of beer, but they used to bang out these bulletins. And they loved me reading the news because I could get 5 minutes worth of news into a 3 minute bulletin. And they loved that. So they would push me as fast as they could, except for one day. I was what used to go and stand by the IRN desk waiting for the bulletin. And I think it was Lynn who was doing it. And at the last minute, he gave it to me and I had to run into the studio. Well, of course, if you run and then you sit down and you have to read the news bulletin, you sound as though you're going to die because you can't breathe. And as I'm reading the first story, I'm looking for where the first cut is. The first three stories were all copy stories, all copy. Well, I get to the halfway through the second one and I just went, and people going, you all right? You all right? Yes, yes, I'm fine. I can't breathe because I've run in here. And so that was good. It was very happy days, I think. It was the culture was sort of drinking and turning out radio, which was unusual in those days because they didn't know. They didn't know what they were doing. You know, the people who were presenting the programmes, it was a first for them. They didn't know what they were doing. And they had a selection of people there. I mean, the age group was a lot different. I was the youngest person, which is odd, because I think I'm now the oldest person at LBC. But in the early days of LBC, I was the youngest person. I think I was about 22 or something like that. And it was lovely. It was in Fleet Street. It was the centre of everything. We had the News of the World over the road, the Sun down in Bouverie Street, the Express down the road, and pubs everywhere. Now it's coffee shops, and it's all changed completely. But in the early days, it was lovely. The printers would stagger back from a pub called The Workers, which was like a bar, and that was open till about 6 in the morning. So, you know, woe betide you if your car was parked in Gough Square. You'd have all these workers weeing up your wheels and everything else. It was a nightmare. But it was such great days, such great days. I remember when Vaughan Rogers brought the radio van back into Gough Square one day, and you had to come in under an arch, but he'd left the aerial up. He'd completely forgotten. And so as he went through, it ripped half the roof off the thing. We had strikes. We had everything. There used to be the ACTT there, run by a guy called somebody White, who went on to join them at TVAM and managed to take them on strike as well. And so we'd have strikes, and all of a sudden the engineers weren't talking to us. And it really was like a them and us situation. And I can remember Douglas Cameron had to do half his bulletins from the radio car in Gough Square.
Now a look at the main points again.
Crossing a sort of pit, morning everybody, here you go, Douglas, impeccable to the last. And everybody standing out there rubbing their hands over a brazier. It was just, was just different. It was just different. You didn't... I don't think we appreciated what we had. The building's gone. It's gone completely. There used to be a plaque on it, Communications House, site of the first, you know, independent local radio, LBC, and that went a long time ago. And it was lovely. It was very special times because you were within striking distance of the West End. You could walk, in theory, to Waterloo Station. There were enough pubs around there to keep everybody happy. It was a very happy little ship, with sort of management who just... Basically, I mean, of course, you know, LBC's saving grace in those days, because it's very difficult to make money out of commercial radio that does news. It's so expensive to source news and to get it in. And it was the Falklands that really boosted our audience. We had Kim Sabido out there.
Somebody's been hit up a front. Graham.
And a team of reporters, and they were just excellent. I remember I was on air for the Iranian embassy siege. I was doing a news programme in the afternoon with Malcolm Brabant down there.
Quick, come to me. There have just been three explosions which have ripped through the embassy building. Smoke is...
And all we got from him was, come back to me. And we did that. I got cut out of the eventual edit, but I was definitely on air that day. But we moved so many times. We went from Gough Square to Hammersmith, and we'd all looked at it, and then they'd had a vote, because the union was very strong at LBC. The NUJ was very strong. John Perkins used to be our FOC until the management came on this brilliant idea, let's move him into management. And he probably told them all of our secrets and everything else, which was funny. And then Peter Dealey had a go at doing FOC. But it was a strong union. If any of the radio stations around the country, their newsroom came out on strike, we had to come out on strike as well. It was one of those sort of situations, because we had the biggest NUJ shop. And in fact, it was a clothes shop. You had to be a member of the NUJ to work at LBC.
Owing to an industrial dispute, normal services on both LBC and Independent Radio News have been suspended for the time being. We hope to resume our regular programming as soon as possible.
We did have somebody, and they would politely ask you to join because it was a closed shop. And if somebody said no, then they had to leave because nobody would work with them. It was really like that. It was the first sort of taste for me of sort of what being in a union was like, and so I was a member of the union for ages. But I don't think it ever did anything for me. I don't think it did anything for me. I was just happy to be in it because it meant if you were in it, you worked. But we went off to Hammersmith, and there was this huge glass building, Crown House. You know, we went in there, went, blimey, it's enormous. And it was owned by an Australian company, and it was all these floors, and at the top was Now News, which went on to B Sky B, or BSB as it was in the early days. And I got a job as a newsreader in Hawaiian shirts, because they didn't tell you which show you were broadcasting into, and you had a foot pedal which operated your auto cue, so it was loaded by the newsroom, and the staff, because there was a window, as there is in all these places, through to the newsroom there. And so the moment the bulletin started, they'd all start being animated, walking behind it. They just wanted to be on camera shot. And I used to have a habit of tapping my foot, and I tapped my foot so much that the auto cue had gone to the end, and it said, thank you very much indeed, good night.
It's 9 o'clock. This is Jonathan Staples. LBC has lost its licence to broadcast to London. The Radio Authority, which regulates the country's independent radio network, has decided not to renew LBC's franchise for its two frequencies. David Kermode reports.
The decision was made at the meeting...
And I was in the shower, and I heard it. They said, LBC, it went out on our news, have lost the licence to broadcast. And I remember thinking, wow, what does that mean? And so I came into work, parked the car, and there was an air of despondency. And then we got taken over by that woman, Shirley Porter, and she decided to start a campaign. So she hired Olympia, the main hall, and sort of did the rallying cry. And we had all sorts of bizarre people turning up. All the LBC cars started going around with Save LBC banners on the top of it.
I just want to... say that the Save LBC campaign is progressing apace. We've had a wonderful response. If you've been listening over the weekend, you'll have heard that everybody is rallying to our cause, it seems. And it only goes...
The new company came in to take over, which I think was Reuters. I don't think they had it for very long. And they probably fired all the presenters. We were all told time after time. We went in there. There used to be... LBC had a Christmas card one year, and it had all the pictures of the presenters. And as everybody came out, we'd either go that, thumbs up, or thumbs down. If the thumb went down, we put a big cross over their picture on this Christmas card. We said, Merry Christmas from LBC. There was only about three people survived. I wasn't one of them. I got told that, I remember that sitting there, and they said, oh, hi, Steve. I said, hi. They said, let's not, you know, waste any time. Unfortunately, we don't have a place for you. Because they were going to do a rolling news or something. Whatever it was, it didn't work. It was the biggest disaster that they'd ever had. But in the meantime, I went off to go and join Viva, which was a women's radio station, with me. Don't ask me why, but my audience profile was apparently women. And I got there, and David Maker, I seem to remember, was the programme controller of, because they owned Jazz FM at the time, and we were based off the Edgware Road. And I pass where it was, almost on a regular basis. And so we went there, and because it was a women's radio station, there were fluffy towels in the toilet. And it was really odd. You'd pick up the phone and go, Viva, and you'd hear a woman's voice going, oh, there are men there. And I go, no, just me. And we had Lynn Watson, who had the PR company, Lynn Franks. She was doing ley lines in the workroom, and everything had to be in purples and pinks and everything else. And it was very odd. It's a very bizarre place. I didn't actually get to go on air because they auditioned me. They didn't audition. I just went in and they sat down and said, oh, blah. And then they started to talk about programming. And I said, OK, fine. And she went, and the salary is this. And I went, yeah. I mean, is this a job? Are you offering me a job? And she said, yes. They wanted me to do mornings. But not only would I have to drive the desk, I had to load my own adverts in and queue the records up and interview. How this was supposed to happen with one person, I have no idea. Anyway, I tried it as a rough test thing, and it was a disaster. But and I didn't stay there very long. I stayed there about 3 months, and it was in the early days, not even 3 months, I think, probably 2 months, the early days of, if you worked for one radio station, they didn't want you working for another one. Now they're a bit more flexible if you're freelance, as long as you're not mainly on-air talent. And LBC had approached me to do a quiz. They'd come back to me. Jackie, who was looking after the station, said, listen, would you like to do a quiz called Loveys? And I said, OK, fine. So there was me, Barry Took, N. Rytel, and an assortment of showbiz luminaries. And they would sit down, and it was all done very nicely. And they were all recorded with lots of famous people talking about their life, and we would ask them questions related to their life. And that went out. And then she said to me, she said, oh, by the way, she said, Robbie Vincent's going on holiday. Could you cover his show? So I said, yes, I don't think we're actually on air at Viva just yet. So I go back there, and Viva at the time is being run by this lady. She said, I hear you've been recording a quiz for LBC. So I said, yes. She said, I think that's a conflict of interest. And so I said, oh, right. So I didn't think it was a conflict of interest. You know, I'm a freelance. Why would it be a conflict of interest? And she said, well, I think it is. She said, so I think we'd better part company. I thought, thank God for that. Thank God for that. It had gone a bit off. So I go back to LBC. They put Loveys out. Robbie Vincent goes off on holiday. I cover for him for a week, and they get a really good reaction. And I was back in again. And it's like my whole life. It's been so bizarre. You know, everything has happened for a reason, I think. Would I do it differently if I did it all over again? Probably not. Probably not. Might have saved a bit more money. You know, you don't think about that because you're too busy enjoying yourself. I've had a few moments where I've been hauled in over the coals. I'm quite prepared to hold my hands up and say that I'm not the most perfect person in the world. Sometimes I make a mistake, sometimes I don't. But generally speaking, I get good radar, mainly because it's 4 o'clock in the morning. I mean, let's face it, it's not that difficult for me to get an audience when all I'm up against is music radio. And I work in nice conditions. And as I say, they're ever so nice to me, which makes, you know what I'm like for crying? I'm like cry at the drop of a hat. You know, people being nice to me, I'm not sort of used to it. It comes out of the blue a little bit. And so I don't go round and sort of blow my own trumpet. I'm just doing a job that I like doing, that I kind of fell into with the help of some nice people. And years later, I'm still doing it. And I'm doing it to the best of my ability. I'm quite sure there's going to come the time when I started forgetting things now. I'm useless.
I know everything about cab driving. You can't tell me diddly squat about cab driving that I don't know about.
I did my one-man show. You came to Croydon. And then you suddenly realise what an outpouring you get from people. You know, people who are just sort of so nice to you for no reason. Perfect strangers will write to you or say... I mean, my favourite was Ivy Hartley. Years ago, when we were in Gough Square, and she wrote in, she used to have lovely little writing, but it was old lady writing, and she used to write in and go, hello, Steve, and she used to write these letters every week, telling me what she'd done, and how our day had been, and all the rest of it, and this went on, I mean, a good year. She was one of my very regular people, and I go, oh, Ivy's written in again, and that was the link. She'd obviously been at home, and she'd smile, and I would read her letter out. And then I got a letter one day but it was another envelope, and inside was Ivy Hartley's letter, inside. And the letter which came to me was from her sister, and she said, I better let you know that Ivy died, but she's left this letter for you as her last letter, and she made me say that that I would send it on to you, so that's what I've done. So I open Ivy Hartley's letter, and she go, if you're reading this, it means that I've died. You didn't know anything about me, nothing at all. You just knew that I was a regular writer. I was in very poor health for years. I just wanted to say that your programme got me through some of those difficult, dark nights and everything else. And I just wanted to say thank you and God bless. Yours respectfully, Ivy Hartley. And I've still got the letter. It's so touching, because you think there's so many people out there listening to the radio. You don't know who they are until you meet them. If you go out and you do, you know, I've done lunches and dinners, and we do stuff for our charity, Make Some Noise. And then you meet people, and they're so grateful to see you, because they say, you changed my life, or you helped my mother, or you helped my father when they were not very well, and they were listening to the programme, and they really enjoyed it. It made them feel as though there was somebody there. And so that's the nice side of the business, that people are nice to you for doing something that you don't really find particularly difficult. I never understand. I went away once on holiday when we were in, I think we're in Gray's Inn Road, and they decided, as opposed to one presenter covering Steve Allen, there would be a whole host of presenters covering everybody from Bella Emberg to Peter Stringfellow. And it was a cavalcade of celebrities, and they all came in, and some could manage it, and some of them couldn't manage it at all, even with the help of producers saying, this is what you have to do. And it was just very odd, very odd, but very strange, but very pleasing. Very pleasing that radio has grown in such a way now that there are so many young people out there, so many enthusiastic people. And all you can say to them is, you know, when they go, oh, I don't want to do an overnight programme, I want to do a daytime show. I said, listen, cut your teeth and do anything. If somebody says, listen, do an overnight programme, grab it with both hands, because that's where you can learn your craft. That's where you can make your mistakes. That's where you can do all the things. And believe you me, they'll listen far more and far more closely to you if you work at night, because it's quiet and you can hear everything somebody says. I mean, I get people writing and saying, will you stop slurping your tea and coffee and turn your blooming phone off? We can hear it bleeping when another message comes through. And you think, that's what it's about. That's what radio is. It reaches out to people. It gives them something. Before I worked at LBC, I lived in a bedsit, and I can remember tuning round the dial and I heard Jeremy Beadle.
Hi, hello. Hello, anybody there? Mr. Beadle here.
Who's called Jeremy James Anthony Gibson Beadlebum on this show, which was a bizarre show I'd ever heard in my entire life, but it became addictive. And then I got to know Jeremy when I worked, because I followed him here, and I followed so many celebrities, but Jeremy was the one. But he would have a studio full of people. All his listeners would come in. They'd be in the control room. They'd be sitting at his feet while he's doing this programme. I used to think, and I'd sit there being really nervous when you got people, and he'd go, now be quiet, everybody. Steve Allen's going to read the news. And they'd go, Steve Allen? And you'd think, oh, God, you could feel the beads of sweat forming. And they all sat there looking, and so you'd try and get through the news as quickly as possible without too much of a dry mouth.
Transport Minister Nicholas Ridley is confirming that the government is considering bringing in troops to replace striking dockers. He says the government won't stand by and watch the country brought to a standstill.
I can't listen back to myself, which probably sounds a bit strange, because people say, to be objective, you have to be able to listen to yourself. Well, I can't. I cannot stand listening to myself. It's not because I don't like the sound of my own voice. No, it is because I don't like the sound of my own voice. It's because I've got an idea in my mind of what I think I sound like. When you hear it back, I don't like it. So I cannot listen now to In Conversations or anything. I do the interview, but if somebody says to me, oh, did you hear yourself? No, I absolutely didn't. I can't listen back to it. And it probably serves me well, because I don't listen to anybody else either. So I don't want to be influenced by what somebody else does on their programme. So if somebody said to me, oh, I think you've based your style on this kind of presenter, I wouldn't know, because I don't know anything about American presenters. I don't know anything about anybody in this country. I knew there used to be somebody called Steve Allen working on another radio station. And, of course, because mine is a stage name, people used to say to me, oh, right, so what's your real name? And I go, well, it doesn't really matter. You know me as Steve Allen. That's all that matters. And I came up with the name going over on the boat to Denmark, because I thought lots of people had two Christian names. So I thought Steve and Alan, that kind of sounds right. Because my name, I didn't think, sounded very DJ-ish. But I think the style is probably different. I think I've probably had a number of styles over the years. The thing is, with me, I can sit down and talk. without thinking about it. I do go through the papers in the morning. That's what I do. And I'll spend half an hour doing that and picking out the stories I want to talk about. But mainly it just, it's sometimes I don't go near the papers for half an hour because I've got too many other things I want to talk about and too many other things I'm thinking I must come. And then I wander away from it. I get a bit scatty sometimes. I thought, right, I'll do this. Oh, wait a minute, did I mention? Oh, I forgot. And then somebody will write in and go, you only got halfway through that story. And I go, oh, right, I'm going to come back to that one. I go back. So you end up going back to it. So it probably sounds, you know, like sort of a Les Dawson character over the fence, you know, Sissy and Ada sort of doing this kind of thing. Because I like to look on it as, I don't know what I like to look at it like. Somebody asked me the other day, they said, how do you see your programme? I said, I don't. I said, it's how other people see the programme. You know, if I talk to people who listen on a regular basis, and I've had people who've listened for 30 years, 30 plus years, and I think, I don't know I've ever listened to anybody for 30 years. And they must notice a difference. You know, I've had people, when people used to write in to me, you know, they used to write week after week. It obviously was a great outlet for them. To me, it was programming. So that was nice. And I think over the years, and you did the same, people are fairly free with me. They let me do my own thing, as long as I don't get them into trouble, which I've sailed very close to the wind on a few occasions. But that's just the nature of doing a programme that is what I call zoo format. It's a freewheeling programme which is based loosely on the newspapers, based loosely on texts and emails that come into the programme, based loosely on me being sort of slightly disrespectful to third-rate, talentless celebrities, which I don't have any trouble with, because I think somebody said to me, you're only saying what we're all thinking, and somebody said, you're not very PC, are you? And I thought, I don't want to be PC. I really don't. I don't want to be PC. I just want to say what everybody else is thinking. All right, occasionally, you know, you get it wrong, and occasionally you think, oh, perhaps I should have been nicer about that particular person, but mainly I don't backtrack on anything. I'm not that kind of person. I just like to do it. And I still think after 36 years, you know, 1979, I still think I'm getting away with it.
And they give you the receipt. And you know damn well they're going to have to ask you the question, do you want the bag? And of course, I've given up going, how else? You know, what do you want to do? Just walk out with it? No, put it in a bag. Don't be so thick.
I'm getting away with it because I love doing it. I'm very enthusiastic about what I do. I don't get tired. I've had after the Archivers, I was a bit tired. I was very tired and emotional in the morning. I fell asleep twice on the programme. I felt myself going. I was reading a story in the newspapers. And I started, and I felt my eyes going. And it was quite a pleasing feeling. It must be like drowning. Oh, I hope you're right. I'm sorry, opening my eyes. And I can't remember where I was in the piece of paper. I said, oh, I'll come up to another story. So I went on with something else. And it was a dreadful day. The producer of In Conversation had booked in two guests that day, and I never forgave him, because frankly, by the time we got to the second interview, I'd seriously lost the will to live. I'd seriously got to that stage where I didn't care, I didn't like him, I didn't like anything about it. I just wanted to go home. And that's the good thing, you know, when you work for a company. And because, strangely enough, you know, since I've been working at LBC, both my parents have died. I've become diabetic. I gave up smoking. I've got stents. I've got all the usual bits and pieces. But that's what forms the programme. That's what you talk about. I talk about my life. Sometimes I have to hold back on little bits of it. I think, oh, maybe I've told people too much about that. Because, you know, because you do get, as you know, we have the internet trolls in this day and age. And you do get people, you know, there'll be a website going, oh, I don't like that Steve Allen. You think, well, grow up and don't listen to it. Go somewhere else. Doesn't make any difference. Some woman said to me the other day in the fruit and veg shop in Twickenham, she said, you're just like Katie Hopkins. I said, what? You think I've got 32 double D? No, I said, I haven't at all. She said, no, you know what I mean. She said, you're very rude about people. I said, well, don't listen then. She said, I can't help it. She said, I have to listen to it. It becomes addictive. People just like it. And I don't know why they like it. I don't know why you'd be listening to me for any length of time. Occasionally, I do recycle. But every day is a sort of a fantastic experience. You see, I can't imagine sort of anybody who wants to do management. I can't imagine anybody would want to do management, because me, that would be so frustrating. I'd be saying, oh, shut up, I'll do it myself. You know, I want to do that. I want to be a broadcaster. Because I think I am a broadcaster. It's just that I don't quite accept it after 36 years that, A, I'm still doing it, and B, I'm still getting... Somebody says, you still like it. I said, I probably like it more now than I ever did. I mean, here I am in the middle of London in Leicester Square, you know, in a big, big building with lots of radio stations, lots of people who are so nice to me. I mean, so nice. I wept the day after the Archivers when I sort of came in here.
And LBC's Steve Allen has been honoured with commercial radio's most prestigious award. The Special Archiver Gold Award is given to those who've made the most outstanding contribution to commercial radio. Steve has been on LBC since 1979.
And people were clapping, and you think, it's so, so nice. You know, because normally, I don't think people know who I am. I don't think that they're just, I'm that funny fat man, you know, wears funny shirts. And people were so nice. And I remember saying, I got home and friends of mine were saying, what was it like at work? I said, I think I tweeted, I just felt humbled. I just felt that it was like an outpouring of love. And you think, from people you don't even know. I got so many Twitters on the way home from the Arkivas. And text messages from people I'd not heard of from years and years and years who were saying, well done, you know, not before time and all this kind of stuff. And I'm thinking, what a nice thing to write. But I don't think it didn't change. It doesn't. I said to the woman in Marks and Spencer, she said, well done, Mr. Allen. She said, you got that award. I said, yes, I said, but it doesn't come with any extra money. It just comes with a piece of glass, which is nice because it's a recognition, isn't it, I suppose. And I've always shunned those sort of things. I always say no. Because I don't think you go into the business to get awards. Some people come into the business for a short time and they get awards immediately. And I think they're very clever. There's some very clever people out there. I'm not a clever person. I'm just somebody who can sit down and talk quite easily for a long time. And I'm at the right rate. You know, financially, that's, you know, this is the rate for the job. Whether or not anybody could do what I do. There's got to be somebody somewhere, isn't there, who can do what I do. I remember when somebody wrote to me, in fact, actually somebody wrote to the management and they listed every presenter at LBC and what they didn't like about them. And I think Ron Onions wrote back and said, dear sir, you should be in show business, and left it at that. You do get people that not so much write, but they'll send an email or a text or something like that. And I believe there are websites devoted to the hatred of Steve Allen, which is fine. You never quite understand why, but then I think they're probably the same people who write to the McCanns and stuff like that. So they've obviously got a load of people in their sites. James O'Brien said to me, he said, why are you reading it? I said, well, at one time I said, a friend of mine said, have you read Digital Spy or something like that? I said, I've never read Digital Spy in my life. And so we went on to it and, oh God, these people are ill. They're a bit peculiar. They've obviously all got quite a few screws missing, but that's obviously what they get off on. But I tell you, for one thing, they listen to the programme so much more closely than people who love you. So much more closely. They literally hang on every word, every single word, because they hate you so much. They want you to say something that they can write about. I mean, somebody said to me the other day, somebody wrote about it, said they'd obviously recorded the programme and copied back everything you said and said, and did you hear him when he said this? He's quite clearly two-faced because he's... And you think, well, why are you listening? You must be so pathetic. And so we all laugh at them now. It doesn't water off a duck's back. I couldn't care less. Unless it becomes dangerous. If I think it's a threat, then we would have no hesitation in going to the police about it. We did it once a short while ago, and the police went round and warned somebody. They said to me, do you want to prosecute? I said, if ever they contact me ever again through any way, shape or form, we will prosecute. I'll drag these people through court. I couldn't really care less. I'd make them lose their job, everything. Because they're writing to somebody they don't know. You know, and then they go, oh, but you're so rude about people. I go, I'm never rude about people. I only ever tell the truth. You know, if I was lying about somebody, then I would expect them to retract. They write things in like, you know, oh, what would happen if Jordan ever met you? And I go, I've met Jordan on numerous occasions. You never said a word. Boy George. I said, oh, I'm doing Boy George. Oh, well, you've slagged him off in the past. And I met him.
Such a flatterer.
Oh, well, get you everywhere. But
and he said, you're Steve Allen. And I said, yes. He said, I know all about you. I said, of course you do. I'd be surprised if you didn't. And we got on like a house on fire. But then, of course, all your detractors don't like that, because that then means that's kind of ruined their argument. That the people who you interview, they say, oh, because you've been told to interview. I'm never told to interview anybody. I always say to people, my producer, Mark, will tell you, he will phone me, he'll send a list of names through saying, which ones do you want? And I'll say, yes, yes, no, no, no. And that's how it works. Because no point in talking to somebody I don't want to talk to. Over the years, and you see people who've lost children who get targeted by trolls. I think Niall Horan from One Direction, they've targeted his parents now and started writing. And you think, what's the matter with these people? But that comes with the territory. Every single person who gets some sort of recognition somewhere, whether it's radio, television, whether you've won the lottery, and there's a bloke on the front page of the Mirror today who has won 6.1 million, he's going to be targeted by so many people because he's gone public and they'll be going, I can't afford to feed my kids and you've got six, but send me some money and all that kind of stuff. And you just have to just lose them. I did have an Ofcom complaint, but then those we deal with, because they've got people who are, you know, we have a very good department and you sit down and you go through it. I think I've had two partial upholds, which is sort of, I mean, it's not good to get anything like that, but that's the thing. One of them went for ages. One of them went for about a year on this thing, and I was proven right in the end. So I always sort of smugly smile to myself and think, I know what I was saying at the time. It's like if I say to you, I'm going to come round and beat you up, you know, like that. I don't mean I'm going to come round and beat you up. That's just an expression. And you have to separate what is in the nature of the program. The Radio Authority always used to say to people who used to complain about, you know, Steve Allen was doing this and that, they'd say, have you heard his programme? That's what he does on the programme. He's rude about celebrities. He's rude about people he doesn't think have got any talent. And he doesn't take any prisoners. You know, and if that offends somebody, well, kind of tough. Kind of tough, because that's what I do. That's how I make my money. And if the company didn't want me to do it, they'd have dealt with it ages and ages ago. So, no, I can't think of anything that's upset me. I've gone home exhausted. I've gone home thinking, if somebody says to me, what was it? There was something a few years back. It was something, whatever it was, and they said, I'm going to report you over that. And I kept thinking, what did I say? I couldn't remember what it was. Because if you do a speech programme and you fly by the seat of your pants and you're keeping it going, I've got to keep the excitement going. But I know more management in this building who listen to my programme, together with the lawyers, and they like it. One of them, who's used to be Chris Tarrant's producer, he said to me, you made me laugh right out loud this morning. He said, I can't think what it was. He said, I just remember laughing. He said, and thinking, I hope nobody's watching me. So they're going to think I'm completely mad. But that's what it's about, isn't it? I don't have any regrets at all. I don't think so. I regret my parents didn't live longer. But that was it, I think, really. I don't know. Left school at 15. No qualifications. Not done too badly. Done all right. Made a living. Got a nice car, got a nice flat, got my savings. I've got all the things that I need. I don't need anything. In fact, the other day, they said, oh, you can take some of your pension. What for? I don't need anything. You know, a young Steve Allen, he'd probably go, not done too badly. Not done too badly. As I say, I'd like it if my parents were still around. You know, my brother listens on Sunday mornings and things like that. So I think the young Steve Allen would say, you didn't do too badly for the boy who really didn't know what he wanted to do and probably still doesn't know what he wanted to do. Because I never had any dream. I never had any ambition to be on the radio. I never had any sort of hankering about being famous. I did think that, you know, by the age of 21, I'd have a white Rolls Royce and be working at Radio 1. That was about as far as it went. Apart from that, I'm not an ambitious person. People, you know, detractors will write in and go, oh, of course, you're still doing the graveyard shift. I thought, yeah, you want to see my bank balance, though. You know, I never call it the graveyard shift because London is a 24-hour city and people are working all the time. And I always go, but you're listening. And they like that, I think. I think secretly they want to be my friend, but that's a difficult thing for them. I think my mother was, I think she was secretly proud. She'd sometimes say to me, Stephen, you mustn't say things like that. You mustn't say things like that about people. She used to work for the police, for the Met police. And she wrote to Pete Murray once. Pete is 90 years old. I discovered that the other day. Somebody's done an interview with him for, I think, The Express or something like that. And he said, oh, I've got a letter to read you. He didn't tell me it's from my mother. And he starts reading it. My mother used to write poetry. And he said, I said, wait a minute. I said, who's this from? He said, it's from your mother. She wrote to me. So when I saw her next time, I said, don't you ever write to Pete Murray again like that. I said, embarrassing me, honestly. So no, looking back, I think I've been very fortunate. I've met some lovely programme controllers, you know, people who are, you know, still working in the business, people who had the faith in me to say, listen, you can still keep doing it. We still like you, you know. And I'm hoping that's how it's going to end. I don't know, actually. I don't know. I sometimes sit down and think, now I've got my little award. I don't think they'd drop somebody with an award, would they? Well, I like to think not, anyway. I like to think not. But you don't know what's around the corner. You know, there might be a lottery win. No regrets. Never have regrets in the business. I mean, the good thing nowadays is that we've got podcasting and recordings of what people were like. And this is probably, you know, the best you're going to get of Steve Allen telling you what his life was like and how he started. And, you know, this will be played long after I'm pushing up daisies and somebody would go, God, let's get some of those podcasts out. And you have a listen to them and go, my God, he did that? Yes, he did that. He did that and he got away with it and it evolved over the years. I think I'm very lucky. But if I was offering advice to anybody coming into the business now, just get your head down, do it. Don't ever question something because there's always people who know better than you. Although I did say to my boss once, he said, it's pointless me trying to teach you about broadcasting. He said, I wasn't even born when you started, which made me feel even more depressed. That's the only thing that depresses me, the age thing. I don't like the age thing. I hate it. It's one of those, you know, I still think I'm 27, 28. Not really, I know. But they are concerned about your health. They're all I think they're frightened I'm going to die on air, which, of course, I'm desperate to do, as you can well imagine. I mean, that would be the ultimate, that would be the Tommy Cooper moment for me, to actually say that he died doing something he loved doing. And also it would be an inconvenience trying to get me out of the building, you know, because I don't have an anorak or anything like that to cover me up with. But that's what I would like. That would be the ultimate thing.